and Lyra too. Strangely, it had the feel of a confession. Stranger yet was the fact that, in hindsight, he wouldn't have changed a thing. Not entirely true. He would have gone outside and warned Lyra to step to the side of the gaping chasm that had claimed her. Aside from that, and the myriad minor fumbles he'd made, but which ultimately didn't matter, the outcome had been great. Grand. Norin freedom. Independence for Narashtovic. You couldn't ask for more. But it had come at a cost. He skipped quickly through his recent stint in Setevan, telling her nothing of his schemes against the king. For all he knew, Taya and Lolligan were still executing a revised version of the plan, and while it seemed highly unlikely Min would care, let alone tell someone, who, about it, he saw no need to expose their operation to any risk, however slight. "It all sounds so busy," she said once he'd finished. "I guess it was. Do you miss it?" "Not yet." He grinned. "I told you my story. Now why don't you tell me how the people of the pocket are so good at hiding?"
"Not yet."
She smiled back. "No need to clutter your head with what might be until you've learned to do more than see a few shadows." "Then let's get cracking."
"Tomorrow."
She stood, shaking one foot to work the blood back into it. "See you then." With nothing else to do, he ran through a few sword and dagger forms, then set aside his blades and practiced seeing the nether. Even after his revelation, it was hard to spot it unless he looked at something alive, such as his hand, or the shiny black beetle that had trundled in during his recitation to Min. He tried to see it in the shelves, but in the dimness of the room he couldn't tell whether the shadows were ethereal, physical, or the spawn of his imagination. Once his irritation began to show up, he blew out the candle and went to bed. No use getting angry over something that was supposed to be fun. What with the lack of windows or daylight, he stayed asleep until Min came for him. After breakfast, they went outside. The sea winds were sharp enough to cut off the tips of his ears. One night inside, and he was already spoiled. "Winter's here," she said, padding southward in the direction of the tide pools. "What do you suppose that means?"
"That the weather is intolerably cold."
"Do you find flippant questions help you to learn?"
"Sure, they drive away the gadflies. Those who stick around must really want to teach me."
"You're right. Asking you about winter is an unfair question, one you couldn't possibly answer." Min walked on, gazing out to sea. "If fall is the season of clarity, winter is the season of difficulty. Everything becomes harder, from the ground to survival. Animals go into hiding. Trees hide their wealth inside nuts. To make it, you have to learn to reach into the cold, dark places."
"Meaning what, in practice?"
"It's time to learn to touch the nether."
"Sounds easy," he said. "I know right where it is."
She tipped her head to the side, neither conceding nor disagreeing. "Most find it the harshest season. Learning to touch it means learning to forge a connection with it."
"Okay, then how do I do that?"
"Why don't you try for yourself?"
"And then we'll see."
Min smiled.
"Who's the teacher here?"
At the edge of the tide pool, he knelt. Min stayed standing, which made him momentarily self-conscious about his decision. Getting a few inches closer to the nether probably would not bring him the slightest bit closer to being able to touch it with his mind, but whatever, he was already down on his knees. More restful, anyway. A blue-finned fish drifted above a brainish lump of coral, nibbling at whatever caught its fancy. Blaze cleared his throat. Bit of an odd thing to do, given that he wasn't about to speak to it, but again, this was his show. And looked. And there the nether was, tucked beneath the fish's scales, looming in its gawping mouth, lurking in its flesh. He reached out with his mind. He thought he did, anyway. He certainly focused on the fish and the nether inside it, concentrating on the wisps of blackness. But he didn't feel a thing. "Is this like when I was trying to see it?" He sat back on the rocks, withdrawing his focus. "Am I touching it, but it's so subtle I just don't know it?"
"Everyone's feel for the shadows is different," Min said. "But when you do feel it, trust me, you'll know."
He tried again, jabbing his attention at the fish like a spear. It didn't flinch. Neither did its nether. He tried coming at it sidelong, whistling a lazy tune while his thoughts snuck closer and closer, all to no effect. He was about to cycle through all these approaches again, then sat back and threw back his head. He was going about this like a stupid person, flailing about like a child with a wooden sword. Speaking of, he was already damn good at one area that required the perfect tuning of his mind and body, sword fighting. And he had a ritual whenever he was attempting to learn a new technique. It had begun as a general exercise, a way to isolate and thus gain control of every individual muscle group in his body. As he breathed in and out, he flexed and relaxed, learning to isolate, say, the muscles under his arms or those in his shoulders. It was a surprisingly useful exercise. It relaxed him, but it also taught him to exert sudden, devastating force whenever he cared to deliver it. For instance, a downward cross-body stroke could be augmented with a sudden diagonal tensing of his abdominals. He might do no more than twitch his wrist, but the extra force generated by the rest of his body could add bone-splitting force to his strike. Over the years, he had adapted the technique into more than a method to coordinate his musculature. It was also a way to clear his head, to get out of himself. Using it, he could learn a new skill in minutes, invent new fighting techniques from whole cloth. By envisioning the combination of movements that would lead to an effective maneuver, he could break it down muscle by muscle, then combine those movements into a single gesture. A few days of practice, and the new technique no longer took conscious thought. As he sat on the rock, he put himself through his paces, starting with his head and working his way down. He tensed his ears, scalp and brow, his neck, then his shoulders, his pectorals and lats, abdominals and hips, and so on. From the corner of his vision, Min was giving him a funny look, but he was already feeling better, more at one with the various components that comprised the blaze he was. He let his breath flow in and out. He reached for the fish. "Oh, shit," he said. "It feels like being stabbed with cold iron." Min jolted forward. "Are you okay? Did you sit on something?" "I felt it. The nether. It's cold and it hurts, right?"
"Generally."
She pushed out her lower lip. "But you can't have felt it already. You just started. Unless you gored me with a pig sticker while I wasn't looking, I think I've done it."
"How?"
she said. "I swooped in on it."
"You swooped in on it?"
"Like a bird of prey." He cut his hand through the air, like a blade closing on the bearer's enemy.
"Impossible," Min said.
"Then do it again." "Whatever you say." He breathed, tensed, relaxed, reached out, felt the icy sting. Though he'd touched it with his mind, not his fingers, he couldn't stop from shaking out his hand. She blinked.
"How'd you do that?"
"Magic. Well, you've magically destroyed weeks of my plans. Does that upset you?" She looked up from the fish.
"I put a lot of thought into those lessons."
"Plans are like newborns." He straightened, retracting his focus from the nether. "Best not to get attached to them until they grow sturdy enough to be put to work." She laughed, then stopped herself.
"Perhaps you'd like to spend the rest of the day honing your new skill.
I have to find a way to build new plans on the ruins of the old.
He thought he pretty much had it down, but it wouldn't hurt to be sure.
As Min retired to the caves, he worked his way around the pools, touching the nether within the snails, minnows, kelp, and a cruising octopus. He didn't see what the big deal was. The nether was there. He knew it was there. So why shouldn't he be able to touch it?
Hungry and too lazy to go build a fire, he cut loose some mussels and ate them raw.
He wouldn't go so far as to say he was getting a taste for raw mussels.
He wasn't sure you could get a taste for nature's phlegm, but he no longer minded them.
Funny how fast you got used to things.
In the morning, he and Min reconvened at the tide pools. He stretched his elbow over his head and pulled it to the side, extending his shoulder.
Figured out what you're going to do with me next.
Tell you about the next season.
Just like that.
She brushed a ragged bang from her eyes.
What were you expecting? A feast in your honor? Shall I fetch the stew?
In truth, he had been expecting something to mark his accomplishment. The progression of the seasons was supposed to take about as long as the real ones, wasn't it? And he'd burned through winter in 10 minutes. Darned impressive, he thought.
He supposed that, in the scheme of things, it was nothing more than a baby step. He hadn't even begun to use the nether yet. This was just his ego standing up and taking its pants off.
Ego could be a fine thing, of course. A strong one could help you accomplish goals even when those goals were plainly boneheaded. And aside from the practical advantages of ego, it was simply fun to have. But at the moment, ego wasn't helping. If anything, it was slowing him down.
When it came time to learn, the role model was the sponge, and he had yet to meet a sponge that was full of itself.
What would all the holes? They could never get enough.
Yesterday's stew can wait.
He blew into his hands. I hope the real winter passes as quickly as the fake one.
A change that sudden would drown us in storms, Min said.
She took a moment, letting her amusement fade and replacing it with a look of authority.
Spring. The next season of melting and unlocking. First you saw the nether, then you learn to reach it. Next, you'll learn to melt it.
Makes sense. It felt as cold as snowman's piss.
It's critical to keep in mind this isn't literal. Though similar in some ways, the nether isn't ice. It isn't water either. Don't confuse a metaphor for what's actually in front of you.
Don't worry. I'm used to dealing with people who are constitutionally incapable of talking in plain terms.
Then get to work.
He ran through his breathing warm-ups. On top of a damp, slimy rock, a fiddler crab was jerking its big claw back and forth, announcing to all the other crabs that it was the most fiddlin' fiddler that ever fiddled. He saw the nether in it, touched it. It was as cold and sharp as before. He intensified his focus, imagining it as the heat of a climbing bonfire. The nether stayed cold, immobile.
He was unworried. He hadn't expected spring to zip by as briskly as winter. The subtleties of fall were still fresh in his mind. After a while, Min returned to whatever other duties occupied her in the caves, but he stayed beside the captive salt water, willing the nether to come forth. A week later, he was still there. He had tried any number of mental tricks, thinking of his attention as heat that would melt the dark ice, that it was a knife that would slice loose the fastened shadows, that it was a big old fist capable of yanking trees out by their roots. He had tried it on crabs, fish, birds, grass, slime, coral, a juvenile shark, a lost seal. And, as far as he could tell, he'd gotten exactly nowhere.
Got any more roots? He asked Min at the end of spring's first week. Preferably something that will cause my brains to pour out my ears so I can pick them up and give them a shake.
Natroot won't do you any good here, she said. She caught the look on his face.
But we can try it anyway. I mean, worst case, we have a good time, right?
So they ate bowls of mashed-up root, and Min sat by the water while he tried to warm, force, and tickle the nether from its obstinate shell. He fell over more than once, but despite one incredibly convincing hallucination that he'd convinced the shadows to swim out from their hidey-holes and leap like a pod of dolphins, he had no luck. Another week went by, never to return. The first snow hit, a squall of swirling flakes that barely had time to crust the sand before a warm wind blew in from the south. Blaze watched it melt with calm fury. Stupid nature, always showing people up. When he calmed down a bit, he tried to take a lesson from that, to imagine where he might conjure up a southern wind of his own. But after a couple of flailing attempts, he threw the idea out like an empty mussel shell. Thinking it would be the strongest and thus easiest to get a handle on, he cut himself to work with his own blood. But that got him nowhere, except bandaged. Finally, so frustrated he could kill something, he climbed up the staircase to the misty plateau, where he could overlook the beach and have a laugh about flinging himself down upon it. The climb felt good. The solid sheet of mist-borne ice on the rocks, however, felt like it might induce death. But there was something bracing about that, something that kicked him free of his snarled irritation and back into immediate survival. So he turned his back on the ocean and picked his way inland. Below, the exuberant tide thundered to the shore. Ahead, he heard nothing, not even the dripping of water. But then he heard voices, one male and one female. They appeared to be conversing, not shouting, so he left his sword sheathed. You don't get brought it because the plateau was known to harbor centipedes as long as your arm. He crept forward, keeping knobby pillars of rock between himself and the two people. Anyway, he didn't need to see the woman to recognize the voice as Min's. He came within proper earshot as their conversation reached the goodbye phase. Their parting words were lengthy, and as it became clear he was eavesdropping on close friends, Blaze grew sheepish. He turned back to the staircase. By the time he reached the bottom, however, he felt less bad. Min wasn't supposed to be up there in the first place. He sat in the sand to watch the stairs. Min walked out a couple minutes later. Her eyes alighted on Blaze, widening. "Went up for a walk," he said. "Just to clear my head," she said. "Me too. Who are you talking to?" She shrugged. "A friend. Who else?" This friend sounded decidedly male. "Afraid I'm replacing you." "Are we allowed visitors, then? Or is that one of the countless things I still don't understand about Pocket Cove?" Min eyed him, head angling to the side. "Maybe it's time to fix that. I haven't been much help this season. Then again, the first time is as much a lesson for the teacher as the student." "I'm your first student," Blaze said. "I don't know whether to feel honored or horrified." "Both, I'd think. Perhaps it's time to take you to my teacher."
"No, I'm definitely horrified."
Min smiled. "At least your instincts are good." She took him to the cave, then had him wait in his room while she went deeper. She returned and nodded. As they walked to the main tunnel and ventured toward what lay beyond, Blaze found himself so thrilled to be seeing something new that he laughed out loud. Min glanced at him, but held her tongue. Torch stones embedded in the walls threw just enough light to reveal the way. They passed a doorway every 10 or 20 feet, each papery door supported on a frame of the bamboo-like reeds that grew on the beaches to the north. The hallways grew warmer, rich with the scent of incense and spices. Although Blaze knew better than to say so,
It was probably to cover up the smell of fish oil that hung in the air, too. Once they passed a young woman in a loose robe, a red scarf fluttering from her wrist. The woman gazed at Blaze with mild curiosity and moved on. After a couple more turns, Min opened one of the parchment doors. A brief foyer opened to a wide room. The walls and floors were so thick with blankets and rugs, it took Blaze a moment to spot the woman sitting in their midst.
"Oh," he said. "You again."
Min's head cranked around.
"You know each other."
"We met a few years ago," Blaze said. "Sort of. I think Dante was too busy blathering for me to get in a single word."
"I remember you," the woman said. Her long, dark hair was streaked with grey. "But we don't get many visitors."
"Really? All it would take is a 300-foot ladder."
"My name is Ro," she said. "Min tells me you're stuck on Spring."
Blaze looked up from a rug woven with a repeating geometric pattern he'd never seen before. "Is that unusual? I thought these things could take months to get right."
"Often, yes. Others find it goes much faster. But after unusually swift advancement, you seem to be...
unable to find my ass with both hands?" He winced.
"Ma'am, if that's what you prefer to be called."
"Ro is fine."
"Maybe I passed my first two seasons too easily, without gathering the tools to go further. Maybe I'm missing something obvious. Or maybe I'm not cut out for this. Either way, I would appreciate any lessons you can manage to pound through my dense skull." She nodded.
"First, why don't you tell me what you've been doing?"
"Well, whenever I try to get the nether to move, I..."
"When you try to do what?"
"You know," he said, "make it melt, make it let go of whatever it's stuck on so it'll come over and say hello." She turned on Min, face heavy with reproach.
"You couldn't have asked him this yourself."
Min held up her hands. "I never told him anything about trying to move it."
"Apparently you didn't do so well explaining the concept of melt, either."
"He's my first student."
"Don't pocket yourself," Ro said, softening her voice. "I'm not berating, I'm explaining."
"It could be," Min said, "that my explanation was lacking."
"Or maybe he really is that dense."
"Ro!" "Oh, she's right," Blaze said. "You shouldn't assume I've understood a single word you've ever said." "You're trying to skip spring and go straight to summer," Min said. "Well, why didn't you say so?"
"You might think there is no difference between unlocking Nether and getting it to move."
Ro leaned forward, blankets rumpling.
"But if you're thirsty, and all you have is snow, you won't be able to drink until you've turned it to water."
Blaze nodded slowly. "And drinking is a special skill of its own, too." Ro smiled wryly.
"Tell me about it."
"Oh, do you have a bottle of something?"
"Get back to work."
This was said friendly enough, but Min took it as an omen to depart immediately. She thanked Ro and took Blaze back through the maze of tunnels to the gusty beach. Sand blew over the dunes in streams.
"I'm sorry," she said. "Yeah, you really trampled the rabbit on that one."
"I should have paid better attention. I've been wasting your time." He wiped his nose against the cold.
"Then I guess we'd better get to it."
"You're dedicated, aren't you?"
"When I have to be."
He resumed his studies at the pools. Min took a more active role, watching him closely. He'd never enjoyed instruction that was too hands-on, preferring to be given the occasional pointer or whack on the head and be otherwise left to himself. But this wasn't like learning to bake bread or sew a wound, straightforward and a mere matter of practice. this was magic. Then again, maybe learning to do magic was as mundane as learning to do anything else. A simple equation of effort and time. Either way, the only way to move forward was to keep at it. Though she continued to keep watch on him, after a few days, Min backed off to let his revelations come at their own pace. For 3 days, a wind blew in that was so warm, Blaze could have sworn it came all the way from the Carlins. When it got cold again, it stayed cold. As for the Nether, his progress with it was as fleeting as that warm snap. A summer blink, Min had called it. But he found that, as he attempted day after day to melt it, to coax it away from the physical world it held fast to, he grew better and better at seeing it, at reaching it. It came faster and stood out sharper. This consoled him, even when, a month into spring, he still couldn't do more than make the Nether shiver. He didn't spend all his time in practice. Often he poked along the shores, exploring closer and closer to the curled horns of rock enclosing Pocket Cove. The beach was nice, somehow placid, even or especially when the wind whipped the waves into sudden thunderous hammers that he jumped out of his skin each time one boomed into the sand. He still missed Lyra. It made him angry that he'd known her less than a year, and had truly been with her for a handful of months. Yet, years after the fact, he still mourned her as if he'd lost some deep part of himself, like a limb he'd never known he had. That was the galling part. He'd been happy before she came into his life, even happier once she was there, granted, but once she was gone, in a just universe, he would have returned to that same pre-Lyra baseline. He had always pushed through his dark moods with a combination of hard work, an eagerness to try new things, and a happy fatalism. Maybe it was still working. After all, he had been far worse back in Malin not all that long ago. But as the winter deepened, and the snows came and went with the wild temper of the coast, he wished to his core that the feeling could be cut from his body like an abscess. He'd suffer a few moments of anxiety, an instant of heart-stopping pain, and a couple weeks in bandages. A small scar left over, perhaps, to remind him to be more cautious in the future. One day, he got up from the tide pools with a sigh, and walked north to clear his head. The wind was bracing and tasted of salt. He passed the caves and kept going. A woman's voice carried over the waves. At first it was so faint and warbled, he thought it was a memory or a trick of the wind. But then it repeated, distorted by the commanding gusts. He squinted out to sea. The water was in chaos, white-capped and as choppy as a bucket lugged in haste from the well. The scream came again, piercing. Something thin and white waved back and forth from the water. The arm of a drowning girl. Blaze kicked off his boots and stripped off his cloak and dived into the freezing sea.
Chapter 13.
All the way to... Dante stopped. He didn't actually know the name of the land east of the Wodans. He'd heard it before, and he knew he'd seen it on Callie's extensive maps, yet the place came up so infrequently he couldn't recall the word. The mountains blocked it off so well, it might have been a different world. He never even met anyone from... wherever it was. Wesley, the old monk laughed, or even further. Who knows? How did we get there? How should I know? Dante flapped one hand. If you know so little about them, how can you be so sure they'll know about Selen? Because they're to blame for our lack of knowledge. They're hiding it from us. Why don't you quit wasting time and talk plain? because this is everything I know. The old monk sat on a fallen log. And even then, I don't know, not with any certainty, but the gap suggests where the knowledge lies. If the answers are anywhere, you'll find them in Wesley.
That had the air of finality. So, too, did the actual air. The overcast light was growing thin and weak. Dante gestured toward the horizon, blocked by trees and ridges. "It's too late to get down tonight," he said. "May we stay with you?" The old monk gave him an amused look.
"You're the reason we're out in this mess."
"Right. I summoned you here. Did you like the gilding on my invitations? Say the word and we'll make our own camp."
The man glanced at his fellow monks, but if any felt like arguing, they were too tired to advance their objections. He sighed.
"It never hurts to have more eyes on the night. But if this is a ploy to learn more about Selen, I can assure you we've told you all we know."
Before the darkness completed its victory, Dante and the others helped cut brush and branches to layer over fresh-cut Shedwind poles. If there were another downpour, it wouldn't be nearly enough. Perhaps Dante would sneak off and build himself a cave, but it would hold against lighter winds and rain. The Hanassin scraped a shallow fire pit, loaded the bottom with rocks, and layered wood over it. This was drenched, of course, but they used the nether to heat the stones, drying the wood enough to catch fire. The smoke was thick and white and smelled of resin and steam. The monks had brought some dried fruits and meat with them. Dante didn't ask to share, though it felt like several days since they'd left Kyoto. It had, in fact, been that very morning, and they still had provisions from the inn. They did borrow blankets, though, drying them by the fire and then settling down on ground that was depressingly wet. The fire shrank. The monks conversed in hushed, mournful tones, then settled down to bed.
"Wesley's really not that far, is it?"
Lou whispered from the dark.
"Why is it that hard to get to?"
Dante rolled over.
"The impassable mountains, I would imagine."
"So, you sail around them?"
"They run all the way to the northern wastes. Even in summer it's frozen. I'll show you the maps when we get home."
"Who says the mountains are impassable?"
C spoke up.
"They do," Dante said, "with their snow and thin air and man-eating kappas. Well, we've heard of the place. You have maps for Lyle's sake. Someone must have been both there and Gask."
"Will you shut up?" the old monk called.
A few of the others chortled from their beds. Dante gave it a moment, then whispered,
"You're the finder, aren't you? So find us a route into Wesley."
C didn't answer. Damp and sore as he was, Dante was also incredibly exhausted. He managed to sleep till pre-dawn, when the monks started rustling around to rebuild the fire, empty their bladders, and dispense breakfast. Dante huddled at the fire, shivering, silently resolving never to return to Hukali again. As soon as it was light, the group turned around and made their way back down the mountain. The rains had washed out portions of the trail, but nothing had fallen since yesterday's downpour, and for the most part the mud was bearable. Back at the clearing, surrounding the monastery, two of the mules cropped the grass, but the third was nowhere to be seen.
"Thank you for enlightening me," Dante told the old monk. "No thank you for making me work so damn hard to find you."
"It comes at a price," the man said. "If you go to the east, you will return to tell me about it."
"Will I?"
"What you're after is dangerous. Some day, long after we're dead, it will return again. This order exists in part to shield the world from the consequences of ignorance. If you believe a word of what you said on the mountain, you'll bring us knowledge of what you find."
Dante took a half step back for a better look at the man.
"I will."
He and the other two rode back down the trail toward Quixote. Lou insisted Dante and C get the mules, but Dante was having none of it, and rotated the beasts between them.
The stablemaster was dismayed that one of her animals had been lost. Silver mollified her adequately. On the piers, few sloops would leave for Narashtovik that day, but given the weather, Dante didn't trust anything so small. He booked passage on a proper, wallowing merchant carrack that would make way for Narashtovik at the end of the week. C took advantage of the delay to go tearing across Kyoto. Dante didn't know what she was after, but when she was that eager to get to work on the Woden's Wesley conundrum, he wasn't about to slow her down with questions. Lou volunteered to comb the local monasteries and temples for histories of Wesley. Dante made the rounds at the piers and taverns, buying drinks for sailors and travelers in exchange for whatever lore they possessed. Their tales were as tall as the Woden's. Squamous dragons swimming the North Seas, eagles so big they snatched sailors from the decks, floating ice sheets patrolled by white bears as big as a house. He was inclined not to believe a word of it, but after encountering the Kappas firsthand, the foundation for his disbelief had eroded considerably. As for roots, however, even the most boisterous speakers were stymied. One woman believed that, in late summer, the northern ice broke up enough to sail through, so long as you could make it past the dragons, and the eagles, and the storms, rogue icebergs, and merciless pirates who claimed the storm-churned northeast sea, where no one else bothered to travel. Dante thought there might be something to her claims, but that would mean stalling their voyage for 8 or 9 months. He saw that as a last resort. A man whose skin was as dark as the mahogany table they drank at told him about a possibility called the Five Medan Lanway. This involved taking the riverway through the Dundons, heading down the Chancet all the way through Malin to the White Sea, sailing past Colin and the Golden Isles to, this is where Dante's knowledge of geography gave out, the territories of Kirkit, where you had the option of sailing up a jungle river, a man advised against this, or continuing all the way around the Southern Horn, until you came to the high steps of Tev. There, if you could sneak, bribe, or fight your way through the nomads, you would have to cross the Mountains of Sorrow, not quite as bad as they sounded, the sailor claimed, and then ride northwest through 500 miles of the Desert of Grass, a relative cinch. This, at last, would deposit you on the eastern fringes of Wesley. "Is that all?" Dante said. "It's not called the Five Medan Lanway for laughs," the sailor bristled. "It's 5,000 miles if it's afoot. And frankly, I think they underestimate. Now where's that next beer?" Sighing inwardly, Dante asked him to repeat this while he took notes. The man obliged, going so far as to sketch a map which he allowed was very much not to scale. Even so, the distance implied by his scribbles was enough to make Dante want to retire to a life of farming. At week's end, the three of them reconvened at the Carrick, a tremendous vessel much too fat to navigate Quixote's inner bay. Big as it was fully crewed and booked, and Dante had only been able to secure one small cabin below decks. He sat in one of the beds, which were little more than hammocks. "Any luck?" "Not much," Lou said, quickly losing the battle with his own bed. "I copied what little there was, if you'd like to read it." "Of course. How about you, see?" "I have some leads to run down in Narashtovik," she said. "I'll make my report then." "Be fast about it," Dante said. She smirked. "You're thinking of trying the mountains, aren't you?" "Every other route sounds more likely to land us in a grave than in Wesley." "The mountains must be snowed in already," she said, "but I'll move with the quickness." The ship weighed anchor an hour later, heaving into the pitching waves. At once, all three of them were wretchedly seasick. So, apparently, were the rest of the crew. Things were so dire, their cabin was allotted a single extra bucket. With frequent excursions to the nearest porthole, they made do. In between vomits, Dante read Lou's records. As he'd said, there weren't many. One followed the picaresque voyages of someone who appeared to have completed the Five Medinlan Way, but the account was so outlandish.
One-eyed giants? Talking mushrooms?
That Dante was inclined to consider it fantasy. It spent little time in Wesley anyway. If it could be believed, Wesley was split into loose factions, with each of its peoples sheltering in a different range of mountains to keep themselves safe from their war-hungry countrymen. Also, their women had two nipples per breast. The other tales were far more fragmentary. One supported the factional composition of Wesley. Another claimed it grew very fine kilnuts, which Dante had never heard of. The others were largely concerned with the feats and prestige of various noblemen who were several centuries dead at this point. Not much to go on. But that seemed to be the name of the game with everything regarding either Selen or Wesley. The only solution to both mysteries was to get across the mountains and see for themselves. On the second day, the waters calmed, and so did their stomachs. They made port in Narashtovik early on the third day. Dante dispatched Lou and C to continue their search for information on reaching Wesley, then went to see Ollivander. He summarized the trip. It didn't take long. "Knowing you," Ollivander said, "I assume your next move will be directly east." Dante leaned forward in his chair. "Well, do we have any other choice?"
"You could always stay here."
"And do nothing?"
"And administer your city, while remaining ready to act should anything more come to light?"
"Ollivander," he said, fighting to keep the irritation from his voice, "do you know what Selen is capable of?"
"Do you?"
"From all suggestions? Anything. Our inquiries suggest its capabilities are endless."
Ollivander folded his arms across his broad chest and sighed through his nose. "Let's hear your proposal."
"We return to Sol. Hire Astmodel to take us through the mountains."
"We," meaning you, Lou, and this bounty hunter of yours.
"We make a good team," Dante said. "Lou knows the Nether and is a born scholar, and C is as savvy as Carvajal. I have the suspicion she can hold her own in a fight, too."
"Wouldn't hurt to have more muscle," Ollivander mused. "Would be a perfect fit for Blaze."
"Blaze isn't here."
"I've noticed. If nothing else, the fact we can keep up our ale supplies would be a dead giveaway."
"So, does this meet your approval?"
"Would it matter?"
Dante pressed his lips into a tight line.
"I am trying to be responsible here. As dangerous as the trip sounds, I think it would be more dangerous to sit on our heels while an object of unknown power manifests in our backyard."
"Assuming it's an object," Ollivander said, "and that it manifests, and if so, that it will be within 10,000 miles of here. Perhaps the fact all knowledge of it is kept in the east means that's where Selen shows up."
"What if Modigan's after it, too, and decides to level Narashtovik as punishment for our misdeeds?"
"It's worth pursuing just to keep it out of enemy hands."
"This is all so speculative, so cryptic."
A cunning look came over his face.
"In that case, Somba will be joining you."
"Somba? Do you expect us to have to do a lot of spine cutting?"
"I just told you that you can go. And you want to argue with my one personnel choice?"
Ollivander smacked his desk with his palm.
"Somba is a walking shadow, the finest infiltrator I've ever seen, and he speaks more languages than a library. If you wind up requiring help from Wesleyan officials, he's the most capable tool we've got."
Dante narrowed his eyes. "And that's why you'd put him at risk, to spy on Wesley?"
"As long as we're making the trip, it would be prudent to learn more of our mysterious neighbors."
"If that's what it takes." He stood. "I'll provide you with a list of supplies and funds. Ask Somba to be ready in 5 days.
That long? Ollivander said. I expected you to demand to leave tonight.
My people need a few days to conclude their research.
This was true, but he also had business of his own. He returned to the sub-basement to get to work. There he began writing down the materiel they'd need for the venture. Mounts, provisions, arms, clothing. That evening, when C and Lou came in from their search, he asked them to add whatever they needed as well.
A bow, C said. Not one of those common-issue ones you give to your guards, either. The good shit you keep for yourselves. Compact but strong.
I didn't know you were an archer, Dante said.
I am when I don't want to let anyone get close enough to touch me.
Parchment, Lou said, and all the things that make parchment useful.
Dante noted it down, adding quills and the like.
And weapons?
Do you expect me to... fight?
Unless you prefer to die unarmed.
Something sharp, the monk said. A sword, maybe?
Something, Dante wrote down, sharp.
We'll liven that up when they write your ballad.
He added to his list throughout the next day, adding and subtracting as new considerations came to light. He wasn't used to this level of planning and foresight. For years, he and Blaze had improvised their way from one disaster to the next, which may have been why there was always another disaster. But there had been something invigorating about leaping into space knowing you'd find a place to land on the way down. Once he finished his list, he blotted the ink, shook off the sand, and stood, meaning to deliver it. When he turned, he crashed straight into a lurking figure. He cried out.
Somba winced.
Was this your doing?
Don't you knock, Dante said. And was what my doing?
Enlisting me on this mad voyage.
Dante shuffled his papers, stalling.
Somba might be excellent at spycraft, but that may have been due to his fiendish paranoia. If he believed Dante was to blame for wrapping him up in this business, he might enact a long-burning revenge that Dante would never think to connect back to him. Yet if he implied he didn't want Somba, that too could earn the man's ire.
It was Ollivander's suggestion, he said. He thought you'd be a significant asset in the field.
I see, Somba said. Then I'll have to thank him instead.
You want to go to Wesley?
Why?
Because I know nothing about it. I've never been swallowed alive by a whale, but I can be pretty sure I'd rather not see the inside of one's rectum.
Somba raised one brow.
He was a small man, the type you might describe as elegant, and each of his motions, however small, was impossibly deliberate.
You met the Hanassans for answers, yet you still know nothing about the place. How can you not be intrigued?
Dante didn't bother to ask how Somba knew he'd seen the Hanassans. The man knew about the trip to Wesley, even though he clearly hadn't been briefed by Ollivander yet. Knowing things he wasn't supposed to was what he did.
Well, I'm glad you're enthusiastic. Let me know what you'll need for the trip.
Somba's brows flickered.
I'll manage my own needs, thank you.
He turned on his heel and strode away. The basement was largely empty, and the smallest sounds echoed up and down the stone halls. Yet as soon as Somba exited the doorway, Dante couldn't hear a single scuff.
The third day before their departure was absorbed by arguments with the Citadel's stablemaster, who insisted they didn't have any mounts capable of crossing the Wodans, and that, even if they did, he couldn't risk such resources on a trip as speculative as theirs. Dante presented the case that the man worked for the Citadel, and that as Dante was the Citadel, he'd better get his damn horses. The man, as stubborn as one of his mules, eventually sent Dante to another stable across town where they supposedly bred animals fit for cold weather. Incredibly, this turned out to be true. The man there had bred stout, shaggy ponies that looked capable of prancing through a blizzard.
After intense haggling, including making a promise to conduct at least 15% of the Citadel's next 12 months of quadruped-related business with the stables, Dante departed with the assurance that 10 of the ponies would be delivered to him the next morning. Of course, they were late by a full day, but after surviving that scare, and what felt like far too much work in general, he, Lou, C, Somber, 10 ponies, and a half ton of gear and provisions assembled in the courtyard. "Don't put your lives on the line out there," Ollivander advised. "No more than is intrinsically involved in the journey, at least. You're more valuable to this city than whatever it is you're seeking." "We'll be careful," Dante said, though that wasn't quite what Ollivander had asked of him. The Citadel gates parted. The procession of ponies tramped into the square. On the long ride to Sol, Dante had time to catch up with what C and Lou had picked up about Wesley. More outlandish tales of the foreign land ensued. Dante had two favorites. The first was a story about a princess who yearned to escape her loveless marriage in Wesley and find refuge in Narashtovik. To cross the Wodens, she concealed herself inside a dead cow, was thusly swallowed whole by a capper, and was eventually excreted on the western side, where she befriended a village and later found love in Narashtovik. His second favorite was that the Wesleyans, who lived in the eastern Wodens, and thus on the west side of Wesley, lived in trees for fear the ground would swallow them while they slept. But there was as little useful info as ever. Dante combed his memories of their first trip, trying to remember if there had been an obvious pass through the range. As he did so, Somber peppered him with questions about the Hanassans, Sol, and Ast. Somehow he'd heard about Dante's encounter with the king, too. "The rumor," Somber said, glancing behind him to make sure the others weren't listening, "is that he lacked adequate proof to imprison you. He let you go out of the hope you'd do something dumb enough for him to lock you up for good." "I thought my freedom was granted a little too easily." "You should know this about giants. When one decides not to crush you, that's because he means to eat you instead." "You should consider writing a book," Dante said. Somber was cryptic to the point of opacity, but he was interesting to have around, that much was certain. Ollivander had been right to suggest him. Above all else, leadership seemed to be about recognizing a good idea when it was presented, no matter the context or your initial resistance to it. The plane slanted up. A bone-chilling wind swept from the mountains. The pony's breath steamed like dragon smoke. They entered the foothills. Each morning the frost on the grass lingered longer. "How are we going to protect the ponies from the cappers?" Lou asked as they bedded down a half-day's ride from Sol. "We'll feed the monsters something else," Dante said. "Why do you think I brought you along?" "It's a valid question," C said. "Then start thinking of answers." They looked unimpressed. "I'm not kidding," Dante said. "For better or worse, you're members of this team. I need you to start contributing on all fronts, not only your abilities, but your ideas. I'll need your help thinking our way through the Wodens. Doubly so once we get to Wesley." Lou wrinkled his brow. "But you do know how to stop the ponies from getting eaten, don't you?" "What if I don't?" "Then the cappers are going to be in for a very easy winter." "You could open a cave at ground level, then seal the ponies inside," C said. "Leave a hole in the wall for air." "Not bad," Dante said. "It's getting cold enough we should do that ourselves." "They're not supposed to like light, are they?" Lou pulled his blanket around his shoulders. "So we build fires, summon lights, and don't let them go out." Dante thought about it. 3 of us can use the nether. We should sleep in shifts. But the cappers have proven they'll attack in broad daylight, too. It would be risky." "Well, I hope you've got better, because that's my one good idea." "It doesn't matter.
What matters is that you contribute. Good ideas are more valuable than Vossen steel. They often take just as many strokes to forge. On the approach to Sol, they had to lead the ponies around the stone staircase. As they rode across the clearing, a horn sounded in the village. Presumably, they'd been mistaken for raiders, but the locals calmed down by the time they'd reached the edge of town. Several villagers had drifted out to see what odd circumstances had prompted a full train of visitors to show up in their backwater on the eve of winter. Vincent exited one of the communal buildings and laughed. "You're back!" "Not for long," Dante said. "We need to see Astmodel." The man rubbed his blunt nose, bobbing his head. "Should he be pleased?" "Oh, I doubt it." Vincent grinned and wandered north into the woods. While they waited, they watered the ponies at the stream and bought a hot meal. They ate outside at the tables. Soon enough, Ast walked up alongside Vincent, tall and grave. Dante stood and shook his hand. "Would you be up for playing our tour guide again?" "To the mountains," Ast said. "As far as I've heard, nothing new has come of the lights." "Not to them. Through them. To Wesley." Ast's head jerked. "Why do you want to go to Wesley?" "To learn what can't be found here." Ast glanced east at the ridges that ran from one side of the sky to the other, as white and foreboding as a full moon. "It can't be done."
"It can't be done," Dante said. "Or you won't do it."
"Even at the peak of summer, you're more likely to never be heard from again than get to the other side. We've brought 3 Nethermancers, 2 of whom have seats on the Council of Narashtovik." Ast frowned across their group. "Nether's no use against Kappas. You saw that for yourself."
"And what if I knew how to handle the beasts?" Dante said.
"Caves won't work this time. Some stretches are solid glacier, and the Kappas are no longer bound by night. They could come on us at any time."
He stopped, as if that would end the discussion, but when Dante stayed quiet, waiting, Ast wrinkled his brow.
"How do you propose to get us past them?"
"How else?" Dante smiled, moved to his pony, and lifted a long bundle from its back. He swept away the cloth wrapper, revealing a blade carved from pure white bone. "With a sword of the gods."
Chapter 14. He had known the water would be frosty, but as he ran into it, high stepping over the waves, its cold ran so deep his muscles tightened like drawn bowstrings. He stopped, found his breathing, forced himself to relax. As he homed in on the woman in the waves, he shifted to a second form of breathing. Within moments, his skin seemed to glow with heat. He knew he wasn't as warm as he felt, but every bit would help. The arm flashed again. Just for a second. Then the woman was back under. But Blaze had marked her. He charged into the waves. One rolled over his waist and nearly swept him from his feet. He ran through the lull. When the next one surged forward, he threw his arms forward and dived into the swell. The noises of the air went mute, replaced by a million swirling bubbles. He swam hard. Another wave passed, and he came up for air, grabbing a quick glance around. No sign of the swimmer. He had a ways to go yet. It was shockingly, paralyzingly cold. Even his little tricks of breathing couldn't keep him going for long. Then he had nothing to do but go faster. He swam on. His clothes were much too heavy. Should have shed those too. As soon as he made it past the breakers and into the still potent open waves, he came to the surface and treaded water. Salt water stung his eyes and dripped down the back of his throat, harsh and desiccating. He stripped off his tunic and kicked off his trousers. As he hung there, catching his breath, he scanned the roiling seas. And there was the hand,
not 20 feet from him. With a flash of white, it disappeared. He thrashed toward it, keeping his head above water so he wouldn't lose the spot. Once he'd reached it, or what he thought was it, waves